the only thing I heard him say publicly, this place is really cold. I'm not even joking.
I believe that's what the I believe that's exactly what the Vikings said when they first discovered Greenland. This place is cold.
Mr. Speaker,
you're at the intersection of business and politics. This is the 14th and G podcast from Melman Consulting. Now, here's our host, Dean Hinkson.
Well, thank you for setting your podcast out of 14th and G. I am your host, Dean Hinkson, here once again in the 14th and G Worldwide Podcast Studios with Republican Bruce Melman, Democrat David Thomas. A podcast that's not always fun and games. It's not always cream cheese here at 14th and G. If I heard one common refrain from our last podcast, David, people were surprised that you and I mixed it up, but you do piss me off sometimes.
Did somebody say cream cheese? I love cream cheese.
He's going to be distracted the rest of this whole thing.
Well, there's plenty to talk about.
Day 70.
We're at day 70. If you can believe
10 weeks.
It's only been 10 weeks since the start of the Trump administration. Much has been accomplished. Much has been disputed. Much has been done on many fronts, and we've kind of got our pick of issues here. We are in the middle. We are in the middle of this work period. It's a 3-week work period before Congress. They'll be back next week, and then they're going to break for Easter for 2 weeks. And I believe they're really going to need it because we got reconciliation trying to get started here in the Senate. We've got Liberation Day. With tariffs and lots of trade information coming out on Wednesday. Markets are up, markets are down, markets are flat. Where do we start, guys? I think maybe we start with Liberation Day. That's how I spent my morning on the Hill talking tariffs. And I can tell you, staff, even super involved trade nerds like Alex Perkins, staffers who follow this hour by hour, no one's quite sure what's coming on Wednesday.
I think that's the defining characteristic. Nobody knows. The most plugged in inside Trump land folks don't know. It could be, it sounds like it's the president's continuing to think across the board, all nations. Reciprocity is the watchword of the day. We're waiting to see the big report on how they want to execute it. At the same time, we know business and many on the Hill are going into the administration saying the unpredictability is scaring the markets and is discouraging some of the investment that they're trying to encourage. But so much remains on. Let's see what they announce. Let's see what they propose. And then let's see how many hours it sticks.
This has got to be. I think you're right on that, Bruce. I think that the only person who does know is President Trump, and I'm not sure he knows what he's going to do 48 hours from now. Maybe he does. I always seem to recall in the years and years that we've worked together, we've always sort of said presidents really don't control the economy. They try to take credit when it's good. They try to deflect when it's bad. But when it comes down to it, the Fed actually can move the economy, but presidents can't. This is a case where the president is, in fact, affecting the economy. And this uncertainty that we're seeing now has the markets down. I checked before we came in, over 3,000 points since the beginning of February. We're only at the end of March. That's a hell of a drop here. And, we'll see what happens 2 days from now, but it doesn't feel good. Maybe this is baked in at this point, but it doesn't feel like it to me. And, this would be the president purposely driving the economy into the ditch to prove a point.
I think that's a little unfair. First, there was the post-election sugar high when the markets went crazy thinking, hooray, tax cuts and deregulation, and didn't pay attention to the fact that the guy was campaigning on tariffs being his favorite word in the English language.
So wait a minute. That is the argument that has been given by, I know, your favorite senator, Tommy Tuberville. The juggernaut that he is, he said, well, you know what? The stock market really was too high. And so now things are getting better that it's dropped.
American stocks are very expensive.
Brilliant. Well, look,
but I think the stocks were pricing in what they wanted to hear and weren't pricing in what was being said. So that's thought number one. Thought number two, and I'm not sure I ascribe to this, but The theory from the administration is that turning a battleship makes a couple of waves, and that America, which I think you and I would agree, certainly a lot of the Democrats have agreed, have become overly reliant and on manufacturing on China. We're not resilient in active ingredients in pharmaceuticals and semiconductors. There's just a lot of stuff we need to make here. The big debate to me is whether you go with a carrots and sticks approach, which the CHIPS Act was the ultimate bipartisan example of, where you both encourage more domestic investment while using tariffs to offset foreign unfair industrial policies, or whether you go with sticks and sticks, which are tariffs and on top of tariffs, more tariffs, which may ultimately drive more investment here at home, but the markets do not like that, and it may be more inflationary, and we're going to find out.
Or I would actually describe that more as a you take a frying pan and hit yourself in the face. That is what this sort of feels like to me at this point here. The U.S. economy came out of the pandemic as strong as anybody's. Now, I'm not going to sit here and tell it was Joe Biden here. I think the Fed had a hell of a lot to do that. And Jerome Powell owes a ton of credit for a safe landing. But it's like we're just touching down from that safe landing, and then we're going to go into a ditch. It's just, to me, it is... Yeah, look, there are a lot of unforced errors, and this is
well,
a big
one. Well, we don't know that yet. I think what the market is primarily pricing in is uncertainty. The market does not know. Our clients, I mean, we're hearing this on a daily basis. We do not know what the policy is going to be, and we don't know what the policy impacts are going to be. We've never done we haven't done tariffs on this scale since the early 1900s.
Smoot-Hawley.
And never.
1930.
How'd that go last time?
And never in a global supply chain world that we live in now. But the point from the point that Donald Trump has, this is an article of faith with the president. He's making this point on Phil Donahue in 1985. That we're getting our lunch eaten by foreign countries. This is a point not dissimilar to what a lot of Democrats were talking about not so long ago, the hollowing out of the middle class, that the top 5% control 60% of the assets and the wealth in this country, and that globalization and global markets have left America's manufacturing economy in ruins and tatters, and there's no purchase there for the middle class.
Anybody who's old enough to be on Phil Donahue in 1985 should have retired a decade
or
ago.
Or Larry King Live. He made the same points on Larry King Live.
There's some, when you think about rhetorically, it's a bit like some of Democrats in the 2010s talking about climate's a problem, and there may be a little bit of a short-term pain necessary for purposes of addressing climate change. That's the theory of the Trump administration right now of there is a manufacturing crisis. We're not doing enough of it. We do 0.1% of all shipbuilding. If, God forbid, we go to war with China, that's a really big problem because they might not keep making ships for us if we're at war with them.
Well, we'll find, and look, you're absolutely right. Love Donald Trump or don't love Donald Trump. He owns this policy lock, stock, and barrel. And, you know, what is going to tell the tale some number of months from now are the leading economic indicators of GDP growth, of unemployment, of all the things, inflation, all the things that people feel and know for themselves and looking at their neighbors. So
how's the Michigan consumer sentiment going, Bruce?
Pessimistic, although the price of eggs is down. But Dean, I think you made the most important point. At the end of the day, tariffs or no tariffs, what we're seeing in markets and we're hearing from businesses is just tell us what the deal is, because they're on, they're off, they're high, they're low. USMCA exempted, USMCA not exempted. What I think right now the reaction is not necessarily simply, ooh, tariffs, but rather what the hell is the policy? And is there anybody who actually has a plan that we can be read in on and thereby do our own planning and our own investing based upon some measure of certainty and nothing about the current environment? You saw the reporting over the weekend. Nobody knows what's coming next. And if you don't know what to expect, you price that in a negative way into the market.
It's not a buy sign. Well, executive branch trade authorities aside, we've got some good old-fashioned legislating going on up on Capitol Hill with the reconciliation effort. They did pass a budget resolution. Those budget resolutions do not agree. After marathon negotiations between Leader Thune and Speaker Johnson, We seem to have some movement forward here in the process. Once again, the Senate comes to save the day and try to get this process off the dime here. Leader Thune has announced his intention to start the process on Wednesday. That could set up another Voterama marathon session on Friday to get the budget resolution done, which is just the first step to unlock the process so the committees can write the bill on defense, on trade, on taxes, on mandatory spending, and so many moving parts inside of this bill. It's hard to keep track, but I think the two biggest pieces are tax. We're going to extend or make permanent the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, the TCJA, the Trump tax reform signature, tax reform of 2017. And to get all of the savings, somewhere between $1.5 and $2 trillion that particularly so many hardline House Republicans are demanding, we're going to do something on the mandatory spending side in Medicaid is probably going to take the brunt of that. So it sounds like they can at least get this process moving forward. They've also got a debt limit extension wrapped up in there. I think it raised the debt limit $5 trillion is what they're looking at. And that could cause some vote problems for Thune with senators like Lee, Rand Paul, Senator Johnson have announced a lot of unease.
Look, neither Lee or Thune nor the remarkably successful Speaker Johnson at the end of the day could get a majority of either conference over the line on this. It's all about the bat phone. And if the president so far, he has been able to get the numbers he needs on all of these things. But we've got, what is it, DT, 52 House Republicans who've never, ever, ever voted to increase the debt ceiling. It's only a question of can the president convince them that this is the time to, go long Greenland and buy some real estate in the frozen north and go long on the debt ceiling.
Not only have so many of these House Republicans never voted for a debt ceiling increase, there are only 85 current members of the House Republican Conference that were here in 2017, the last time we did a Republican reconciliation bill, that was the Trump tax bill. So there's a lot to learn on the reconciliation process. I feel like the House watches their bill go through the meat grinder in the Senate, which is the bird process, and it's a fresh hell every single time.
There's so many little parts of this that we could discuss right now. How will the parliamentarian rule? What's our baseline going to be? Those are some great questions that I'm looking
for. Will they try to roll the parliamentarian?
Will they try to roll the parliamentarian? What does Rand Paul do? Does he have any comrades in arms who are going to try to sink this? The margins are so close in the House and Senate that it is, you're right, the president's going to need to lean in on this if he wants to get it done. I would argue he's already leaning on this by throwing Elise Stefanik in front of the bus, not under the bus. She just got rolled over. She had tweeted out last week a picture of her and Linda McMahon and a few other cabinet secretaries at the White House saying, just enjoying the White House with my fellow cabinet members. Like, oh, that's a shame.
Is the UN ambassador a cabinet member?
No. Yes, are they are cabinet members, but you know what she's not going to be? The UN ambassador. it's remarkable to me that somebody didn't think ahead of time, like, these margins are going to be closed throughout the year, not just when we have to do a speaker vote in January. But, Trump is a wrecking ball. He destroys everything around him. And now Elise Stefanik, who I would argue sold her soul to suck up to Donald Trump.
Oh, my goodness.
She was a George W. Bush White House staffer. Can't be more traditional than that. Am I right, Bruce? You know what it was like to work in the George W. Bush administration.
That was a button down
Bush before
operation.
She was against Bush, to quote a great Democratic presidential candidate.
And now she's
I'm with Dean, got nothing.
But no, I just want to point out that I think the president said to the effect of, that's fine, people love her, we're going to keep her in the House, she does such good work, and she'll be in leadership, she's going to be, she'll be the chairman of the committees, which I don't know what position that is that she will take, but
Well, let me just say,
who can say what might have been?
If he said that and it's not yet a position, it will be soon. But I'm with you, Dean. I think there has been cabinet inflation. Forgetting Stefanik for a second, UN ambassador shouldn't be a cabinet
position.
It
should not.
That's ridiculous.
But come on. This is the United Nations. And if there's one operation that is ripe for being doged, it is the United Nations. So I have a modest proposal. He's extraordinary. He's plenipotentiary. Ambassador Big Balls. Come on. Put him in the UN. Get him in there. My colleagues are shaking their heads.
I believe we've gone off the rails at this point.
My colleagues are shaking their heads in dismay.
Let's take this conversation up on our Signal chat, fellas.
Do we want to go Signal chat?
Oh, yes, we do.
Oh.
Do you
have a hot take, David?
TT has been dying to talk about
yes.
this. I believe that's why we're doing the 14th of June today.
I think this is, in all seriousness, this is the dumbest scandal since Rudy Giuliani tried to call the Four Seasons Hotel in Philadelphia.
The Four Seasons Landscaping.
He tried to call the Four Seasons Hotel. He ended up at Four Seasons Landscaping.
All credit. They actually had the press conference at Landscaping.
The National Security Advisor went ahead and had his Snapchat with the cabinet. And
Snapchat would have been preferable. It would have all disappeared.
Yes, Signal. To me, it's a little bit funny. We've all added
smiley face
to a text,
emoji
accidentally here. No, it's a muscle emoji and fire. But this just shows what we've known all along. Donald Trump has no respect for anything classified, for secrets. He kept all these documents down in the can in Mar-a-Lago. And now, what are we surprised that his cabinet has no respect for things that are classified either? I'm not surprised.
Maybe he should have kept them next to the Corvette in the garage. I don't know.
I didn't see.
Let me just say
the National Security Advisor to President Biden doing signal chats on upcoming bombing missions with a member of the Biden cabinet.
I would say this: documents at the Biden Center at the University of Delaware are way more secure than on Signal. I'm just saying, because nobody is going.
Nobody's going there.
Speaking of,
but there are more of these. I am confident there are other Signal chats out there that Mike Waltz sent around with God knows who, which we probably won't find out about because all the inspectors general have been fired. Donald Rumsfeld is definitely rolling over in his grave when Pete Hegseth is sitting at his desk.
Is Rumsfeld dead?
Hey, look, you don't go. You don't go to war with the group chat you want. You go to war with the group chat you have. I think we can all agree on that. Speaking of those margins in the House, we've got some special elections coming up in Florida. I think there's another one.
Two in Florida
and the Wisconsin Supreme Court nail biter.
Do these things, like we go through this at the start of every administration. The specials they win, but by not as big a margin as the president won in that district, or maybe some reverse. Do these really tell us anything at all about the current political climate?
Well, they tell us a couple of things, I think. First, it's a +5 margin for the GOP in the last election, 220 to 215. And I know there's some vacancies because of folks who passed away, but if you lose when your margin is 5, that's really different than if you lose when your margin is 40. So first, you're playing with live ammo. Second, what to me they tell us in part is the nature of the party's voters have changed. It used to be the low propensity voters, the people likelier in primaries, the people likelier in special elections and off-year elections, were college educated, likelier to vote Republican. So Republicans always wanted to low turnout elections, they were going to do better. And Democrats are like, everybody should be able to vote by blinking. Now, Democrats keep winning the specials because Democrats have the high propensity voters. And as Nate Silver found, if everybody who could have voted in 2024 had voted, Trump would have won by more. He'd have had 52 and change percent of the vote. So that's been a trend in the last 5 to 10 years. I'm really interested to see how much, once again, it proves these are Trump +30 and +37 districts. So if the Dems can snatch a win in either of the ones in Florida, that would be something. I don't believe Signalgate and I don't believe Matt Gaetzgate helps for the Republicans, but they're big, big margins, DT, to overcome.
Yeah, I
you got the money for it.
No, I'd be shocked if the Dems pull off a win in these seats because they are so ruby red down in Florida. That would be stunning. If they're close, the Dems will make a big case. Look, that people are out there, they're angry. I think to me that's a little bit more interesting here is the grassroots anger that we're seeing out in the country here, these Republican town hall meetings. Where we're seeing a lot of anger on what's going on in Washington. It reminds me of the lead up to the 2010 elections, which is really the beginning of the Tea Party movement on the Republican side. Is that something that's going on here now? I think there is real concern among Americans, and we're going to see if that translates into. But also, interestingly, there's a lot of hostility towards the leadership amongst the Democrats here. The Democrats really don't have a leader right now. In my 30 years here, it's the first time that we really don't have a head of the party. Last time Trump was here, it was Nancy Pelosi was not just running the House, but running the Democratic Party here. We don't have that right now. I've talked to a lot of House members in the past few weeks here who've gone out and done their own town hall meetings, and they say the furor with Senator Schumer's decision to help get the CR done is real. And so Bruce and I, we spend a lot of time talking about how the opposition eventually will rise up. And I think that will happen with Democrats, too. They are, Democrats are dispirited. They're lost in the woods. This is the worst place we've been in since 1984. Fill in, any of those will do here. But there's something going on out there. We'll see where it goes.
Although, interestingly, our colleagues, DT, on your side of the aisle, have told us that they think it's rude and wrong for us to use the word or the phrase Democrats in disarray. That has become the new prohibited phrase. I tend to think your instincts are right. The Dems are certainly in the wilderness, but nobody ever stays in the wilderness. There's also the approach that some in Republican leadership have proposed, which is if you don't hold town halls, then the voters aren't angry anymore because you didn't hear the voters being angry.
Hold teletown halls. Don't hold in-person town halls is the advice.
Ah, got it. Because, yes, it's... I'm sorry, can you hold, please? That never offends anyone.
There's no shortage. This actually goes back. There was an interesting James Carville piece in the New York Times a couple of weekends ago.
Speaking of Phil Donahue watchers.
I know. But he said, and I think he's right on this, is that... at some point, Trump is going to implode on himself. He's had a pretty good run for the first 70 days here. At some point, do the Democrats need to go up there punching him, or do we let this thing sort of flame out a bit? It looks like the decision has been made by most Democrats who could be those leaders, like, let's give them time. You don't really see Shapiro or Pritzker or Westmore or Gretchen Whitmer. And we got a lot of governors who I think could sort of rise into that spot. I think they're taking their time. The only one who's really out there trying to be taken it to him is Chris Murphy in Connecticut, who's really sort of, I think, trying to become the leader, spokesman, whatever you want to call him, for the Democratic Party. Most others seem to be taking a little bit of a step back. Let's wait and see.
Well, be careful what you wish for in the form of an organized Tea Party movement. A lot of the energy of the Tea Party was focused on the Obama administration because that's who was there. But the Tea Party came about, I think, more so as a reaction to the Bush administration and where it was the rise of the populist movement inside the Republican Party that is now in control. And before they did anything effective against Obama, they ate a lot of their own in transforming the Republican Party and making that realignment that we're living in today. Well, that's coming up on 25 minutes for us as we've covered as much of 2025 as we could get to. We didn't get to Greenland. We didn't get to Trump's third term. We didn't get to Trump as executive director.
The Biden book bonanza that is April.
Of the Kennedy Center. The president now runs the Kennedy Center. A revival of Meet Me in St. Louis. Something.
I think a permanent residency for Lee Greenwood is in the mix over there. It's going to be just great.
He's endowed Greenwood chair.
But we will be back. We will be back to figure all of this out.
Sad.
A happy Liberation Day to all those who celebrate. And we'll be back to cover all of 2025 in 25 minutes with my good friend Bruce Melman, my good friend David Thomas. Thank you for joining me on 14th and G.
Thank you, Dean.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to today's podcast, brought to you by the lobbying firm of Melman Consulting. For more, just type 14th and G podcast into your favorite search engine, or look for 14th and G wherever you get your podcasts, and subscribe.
Beam me up, Mr. Speaker.